We're talking about direct primary care here on The Morning Show. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Direct primary care is a different way to create an agreement between healthcare providers and patients. It's more membership-based. A recurring payment gives you access to basic healthcare instead of individual billing for visits. Have you heard of this before? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're part of a direct primary care agreement. What have you noticed about the quality of your care? Do you see a difference in cost? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Corey Peterson is a writer and research associate for the group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. She wrote an op-ed piece in the Capital Times advocating for laws in Wisconsin to support direct primary care. Corey, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're seeing direct primary care providers crop up across the country, some happening here in Wisconsin. Help us understand a little more about how this model of healthcare works.
So you did a very good job explaining it. It is very basic, and there's actually, I think people often question how basic it is. You know, there must be insurance involved, there must be more paperwork, but it really is just a subscription model for basic care. Where you have an agreement with a direct primary care provider. An example I like to use is UrMD in Mequon, Wisconsin. A family can pay them $150 a month for a subscription, $30 extra per child, and receive primary care through them as well as urgent care and things like lab work.
So who creates these agreements with patients? Are we dealing with medical professionals or hospital systems or independent doctors, non-doctors? Who's making the call?
Yeah, so it's actually a lot of actual doctors. So we're not talking about non-doctors. I think occasionally you can have a DO, which is not, some people would say it's not a full doctor, but most of the time we're talking about full MDs, and it's a private practice. Just an agreement between any patient in Wisconsin and this in a private practice.
And direct primary care is touted as something that allows doctors to spend more time with patients. How does that become a reality with this agreement?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why a lot of people are turning to it. So the problem that we hear often with insurance is that doctors spend so much time submitting costs to the insurer that they actually don't get a lot of time with the patient. So studies have shown that doctors that have primary care practices actually are able to make money seeing fewer patients. So the average direct primary care doctor sees between 600 and 800 patients per year, as where the regular doctor in the fee-for-service model, which is the model we currently is the most current, common current model, see close to 2,000 patients a year. So we're talking like a third of the patients, which means better care and better service, a lot more attention paid to the patients.
How do you make sure that number of patients seen doesn't balloon past that then, that they don't get up, that direct primary care physicians don't get up to the number of patients that traditional doctors have now?
Well, it really is just an option that's open to people in Wisconsin or open to people across the country. And so if they feel that their doctor doesn't have enough time for them, they can cancel their subscription and go elsewhere. But it's really based on what the patient wants, and it's really a consumer-driven model.
Okay, so is there, we're talking about state law that we may be able to help make this an option for people in Wisconsin. Would you expect to see any sort of regulation about ratio of patients or anything like that to kind of make sure that some of these opportunities that come with direct primary care are there for patients?
So to be clear, it already is an option in Wisconsin, but what the legislation would do is it would codify it in law to protect it, because since it actually is not insurance, we would want to make sure that it's not regulated as insurance is. And there are other regulations we want to protect it from under the Affordable Care Act as well. But no, we would not expect to see high regulation in this option, because what we have here is something very basic. It's not catastrophic coverage. Nothing extreme like that. This is just a basic primary care plan where you can go for your regular doctor visits, and it doesn't cover specialists. It doesn't cover anything outside of that.
Corey Peterson is a writer and research associate for the group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And we're talking about direct primary care. You're part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think direct primary care is a viable way to replace health insurance costs? Or do you think we have better options? What do you see? Maybe you sell health insurance. What's your take on having the option of direct primary care? The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Corey, you were just talking about this basic primary care. Help us understand how direct primary care models account for people needing care from a specialist, maybe one that they couldn't even afford without insurance.
Yes, so this is an option that people would choose to have who possibly aren't receiving the current insurance through their employer or aren't enrolled in Medicaid. And if they needed to see a specialist, if their direct primary care provider felt they needed to see a specialist, that would be outside of their plan and would be paid for out of pocket, or perhaps if they did have an insurance plan and still paid for primary care separately, they could use their insurance for that. But this really is for people who are looking for just basic care and aren't expecting to see a specialist.
I understand how that works for people who have chronic conditions know that they will need to see specialists. But, you know, isn't there a chance that any of us searching for direct primary or for regular primary care would need to be referred to a specialist? I mean, that's why the direct primary physician is the general practitioner is on the front lines of this to make sure that we're healthy and, if necessary, escalate the level of care. I mean, how do we make sure that people don't actually set themselves back financially by taking up this direct primary care option that's less expensive for them on the front end?
So that's really up to the patient, because the reason for direct primary care is that there are people in the state who currently can't even see a primary care physician because they can't receive the employer insurance and they're not on Medicaid. And so this is for people who want to buy their own care because they don't receive anything right now. And so primary care for them is all that they're looking for. And so you're right that it potentially could be risky, but what we're advocating for is that people would have the option to do this. And so it would be entirely on their own volition. And it's something that we're seeing that people really want. Across the country, there exists about 800 DPC providers in 48 states and 250,000 patients. And this is something that people aren't being like, the government's not suggesting they do. Nobody's suggesting they do it. They're choosing to enroll as a patient in direct primary care. But it's a relationship very much decided by the patient. And if they feel they need to receive better insurance elsewhere, they can pay for more expensive plans. But this is a cheaper option that they should be allowed to have.
Gotcha. Yeah. And those numbers you cite are from the McIver Institute. So we should just mention that was information that they were able to provide and that you were able to write about when talking about direct primary care. This is a continuing conversation here. We are talking about direct primary care services as a way to bypass traditional health insurance, still get patients access to medical care. Corey Peterson stays with us saying that this is actually an option for people who may not be able to get access to physicians immediately right now. Could be an option for people who don't have insurance through their employers or through any other option that is affordable to them. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Do you see promise in this new model? What drawbacks might worry you? We're taking your calls, your questions now as our conversation continues. 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and right now we're talking about direct primary care. These agreements usually focus on basic family medicine services. It's a contract. Patients pay a monthly fee, and doctors provide standard office visit medical care for people enrolled. Are you a direct primary care provider? How has that changed your relationship with the people you serve? Maybe you've never heard of this before. Do you think this strategy has promise, or does something about it give you pause? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Corey Peterson advocates for laws in Wisconsin to support direct primary care. She's a writer and research associate for the group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Corey, how does this direct primary care funding model work for hospitals? Why are they turning to it?
So this is not something hospitals are turning to. This is something patients are choosing to turn to. So the way it works is this. A patient will pay either a monthly or annual fee to a primary care provider to receive primary care as well as potential urgent care or lab work. So very basic services.
Okay. And
the monthly fee is something we're talking about, like $150 a month. And it's for an additional child, $30 each.
Sure, which is drastically different than many of the insurance plans that I've seen and that our callers have talked about. And I know you say that the hospitals are not turning to this, but they must be allowing for physicians to do this or somehow, making it possible. So there must be some advantage for hospitals, right? Because otherwise they would be collecting more if we used insurance. Or is that not the case?
So this is something that's very much outside of hospital networks. And so hospitals potentially could be for it or could be against it. But the people we're seeing advocate for direct primary care are largely patients and then doctors who are hoping to have closer relationships with their patients and spending less time on all the paperwork that insurance requires.
All right. And what about when we're trying to figure out if direct primary care would be right for us? Is there a way to help us understand whether the traditional insurance plans that are available to us might be better or worse off compared to direct primary plans? Is there a website or some sort of comparison tool to help us figure it out?
That is a very good question. I actually am not aware of a current website that would help that. However, there are a lot of really great tools available through specific primary care providers, direct primary care providers. So if you visit your MacWan for Wisconsin residents or your MD in MacWan, they have a great website that will list their options and show exactly what they cover. The people who would be interested in direct primary care are potentially people who either aren't on Medicaid, but aren't receiving insurance through their employer, and so the plans that they're looking at are quite expensive if they want to insure themselves. So they might decide to take the risk if they feel very healthy, and pay for a cheaper plan like this. They also could potentially pay for this along with their insurance if they receive insurance through their employer, but they're not happy with their relationship with their doctor. I guess there could be a potential person who would do this, who would pay for direct primary care just so that they could receive direct care through their provider without having to go through insurance.
Jessica from Platteville called, says she works in healthcare and says she's concerned this wouldn't really save people very much money because from what she's seen, when people go bankrupt, it's because of those specialist or emergency visits. And so it sounds like you and Jessica are actually on the same page saying this plan might not be for everybody.
Yes, I completely agree that this plan might not be for everybody. What we're advocating for is that people would have the option to enroll in direct primary care if that's something that they feel is good for their family. But as I have said, it doesn't cover everything, and so they would be having to weigh the costs with that.
Corey Peterson joins us from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and we're taking your calls on direct primary care. What do you think? Is it too different from traditional health insurance to ensure quality? Or do you think that this simplifies the process of really expensive health care? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Corey, I do want to get to the fact that a bill was introduced in the state Senate in February intended to regulate direct primary care in Wisconsin, set some regulations. It hasn't passed. What's it trying to address?
So this bill is trying to protect. So direct primary care, to be clear, already exists in Wisconsin.
Right.
So what this bill would do is protect what already exists by not requiring, making sure it's defined as something different than insurance. And also something different than
and therefore not having to apply to certain Affordable Care Act regulations. And so defining exactly what it is in the state law would allow it to exist. It currently is operating in some what you might call like a legal gray area. So this would just codify it in law and keep it safe, and just as an option for consumers. So and just to be clear, this has been something that has been proposed in different since 2018 in Wisconsin. And in 2018, the legislature decided that they needed to do more research on this. So a bipartisan committee was put in charge of research and came back unanimously saying that the potential impact on the healthcare delivery system in Wisconsin would be favorable for consumers. And then we also saw Evers introduce this in his budget at the beginning of the year. So the current bill is put forth by Republicans, but we have seen bipartisan support for this.
Yeah, no Democrats have signed on yet, to my understanding. But right, okay. We do want to bring Tim from Delavan into the conversation. Then, Tim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. What question do you have?
Say, down by me, there's a company that opened its own clinic, but they allow the public to come in, and you can see a doctor or a nurse practitioner for $35, just a flat fee. There's no insurance. They don't take any insurance. They just take cash. That's it. And then, obviously, the costs are above and beyond that, but how is this different? I mean, that sounds like a pretty good deal. If you're sick with a cold or a flu, you can see a doctor for $35.
Interesting. Thanks, Tim. Corey, Tim, wondering how that flat fee is different than the more membership-based idea of direct primary care.
So that's a great point. So some places do provide services for a flat fee. And so, yes, exactly. People can see a physician just when they're sick. And it's a great option if you don't have time to wait for your doctor or if there's a specific doctor you want to see and you're outside of insurance. So that's a great option. We see a lot of primary care providers providing the subscription model, but also what you said, just for a basic checkup, you could pay $35.
Interesting. Yeah. And Bryn from North Freedom wants to join the conversation, too. Bryn, thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to call and comment that although personally this would be too risky for me, even though I would be someone who would be healthy and don't really see a doctor, even though I have insurance, I do think it should be an option at this point. However, I think it points more to the universal health care option really being needed. My fear with the direct care is that although some people will get more care because right now they don't have any care, the people who end up needing specialists and don't have coverage will be in a bad situation, end up in emergency rooms, et cetera, which I just think overburdens our system, and I think really it pushes towards the need or evidences the need for the universal. That way, the overall cost, you know, people aren't, I guess I'm not using very good words to explain, but I think it just shows a need for that system.
We understand what you're saying, Bryn. That makes sense that you're trying to figure out. You see kind of a broken system, and you're looking for some solutions there. Corey, is this one piece of our healthcare puzzle?
I absolutely think this is a piece of the healthcare puzzle. For me, whether we're talking about in the future using universal healthcare or whatever we're talking about, this is a good answer for right now. This is a very basic thing that our law could protect. And it would allow for people to receive this care in the meantime if this is what they choose. But as we said before, this is not for everyone. But I agree with the caller that yes, consumers should have this option.
All right, and let's bring one more person into the conversation here. George from Milwaukee has a quick question for us. George, what's on your mind?
Yes, thanks. One question is: does this plan include OBGYNs for women?
Oh, okay. Good question. So other than like the primary family doctors, GPs, do we know if direct primary care would work with OBGYNs, or is it strictly for general practice doctors?
So this OBGYN would be considered a specialist doctor. So this would be for just a primary care provider.
Okay. All right. And in just the minute we have left with you, Corey, time goes so fast. I wonder how you see, because this is a Republican-sponsored bill right now, this measure, and Democrats haven't signed on, how do you see both sides engaging with this issue moving forward?
So I'm really hoping that Democrats will get behind it, because they have been behind it in the past. As I said, the research committee that the legislature put together was bipartisan, and it came out unanimous saying this would be good for Wisconsin. And then we saw Governor Evers also include this in his budget in January. And so I'm really hopeful that Democrats could get behind this as well. As of right now, they are not, though.
All right. Corey, thank you so much for breaking down Direct Primary Care for us. We appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you very much.
Corey Peterson is a writer and research associate for the group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We've been talking about direct primary care and how it could be a viable option for connecting patients with healthcare providers here in Wisconsin. Coming up next, we're talking about New Year's resolutions, how to make them and how to keep them. You can join the conversation with us. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. You know what that means. It's time to take out your notepad and your pencil, open up a document on your computer, or tap an app on your smartphone. It is December 31st, and we're talking New Year's resolutions. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Just one day left until the clean slate that is 2020. Let's set some goals together. What are your New Year's resolutions this year? And how do you really plan to keep them? Maybe you have a really successful goal that you've set in the past that you want to talk about. How did you make it there? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Here to answer our questions is Shyla Morgain in studio, talking us through this year's resolutions. She's a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. Her specialty is in health and sports psychology. Shyla, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
When we're thinking about these changes we might want to make in the new year, it's a natural time. Where do we even begin?
Well, it's not only a new year, but it's a new decade. So it's a great opportunity for people to reflect and even take some space to think about what they want to achieve this next year. And New Year's resolutions can be a really effective way, if they're done properly, to really chart your course for success. And there are just some simple strategies that can really allow people to take that intention into action and then translate that into success.
And because it can be a little bit daunting, what questions should we ask ourselves in the beginning to kind of make the list that we will eventually winnow into our New Year's resolutions?
One of the things I always encourage people to do is to reflect on the year ahead and think about your future self a year from now and envision him or her. What would you be doing? How would you be feeling? What things will you feel good about achieving? And often starting from that endpoint in mind can help you really know which direction to start moving.
That's interesting, because I feel like I start the opposite way. I think, what didn't I accomplish in 2019? What don't I like about the way that my life is right now? And how do I change that? You're saying flip that script.
Absolutely. To begin with, it's always good to start with the positive and to think about what your inner motivations are. You know, what lights you up? What would feel really exciting to work towards? And maybe that second step can be what you just talked about, to think about things you didn't achieve. But I think if you start there, it's kind of with a negative, right? And you start to lose some motivation to begin with.
Okay, so we want to start out on the right foot. What about achievability? How much should it be a really lofty goal? And how much should we be thinking, can I really manage this in the next year?
That's a great question, because we know that within a few weeks, 90% of those resolutions are already broken. And I think the biggest mistake that people make is they set them too lofty and they don't have a sustainable plan. So when you think of the goal, it's okay, or the resolution, it's okay to dream big, but you also have to break it it down into small action steps to get there. And you might think about, yes, I want to achieve this within the year, but then chunk it by month to month to month. And you might even then break it down even further with what's one thing I can do this next week. And when you're setting those small goals, it's always good to make them SMART. SMART's that acronym that stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-based. So you want to be really specific and small. It should be measurable, like what are the specific things I'm going to do this next week? It should feel attainable, like, gosh, I'm 80 or 90% confident that I can do this. It should feel relevant to you, because oftentimes sometimes resolutions can be things that other people want you to do, like your spouse wants you to do or your doctor wants you to do, versus something that's really important to you. And then that time-based, usually chunking it a week or two at a time, can really get you going with some good momentum.
And perhaps working through that helps us understand, okay, maybe this isn't a one-year goal. Maybe this is really more like a five-year goal. And then there are additional increments in there if we have been thinking big term, like, I don't exercise at all now. Now I'm going to exercise every single day. That might be a really dramatic change that might not fit into somebody's work.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are creatures of habit that we tend to go back to the status quo of how things used to be. And so we never can get rid of a bad habit. Instead, we're really thinking about building new habits that can override those original negative habits. And when we're forming new habits, it's repetition, repetition, repetition. There's one study that found that it took an average of 66 days for something to become a habit. And there's still a lot of variation among people. But I think one of the big takeaways is that it can take longer than we expect to form a new habit. And often people give up too quickly when they're not seeing the results that they want.
Right. 66 days. You know, even if you're average, it's more than 2 months of having to commit to something that is pushing yourself beyond the routine and the habit to try to create a new way of working. That feels, like that's real effort, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And I could see after 3 or 4 weeks going, wow, this isn't working. And you're saying, give it a little more time.
Absolutely. And it's often looking at the behavior is the goal versus the outcome. So if I think about the person wanting to start to exercise, they may really be focusing on weight loss as the ultimate goal. And so if they go for 3 weeks to the gym and don't see any pounds lost or only see one or two, they may lose the motivation and momentum. Instead, if they can just focus again on the behavior, like I'm going to not expect perfection, I don't have to go every day, but if I can just go, let's say, 3 times a week and plan for that, then you feel that sense of achievement that, yeah, I went to the gym versus focusing on the outcome of the weight loss, where you might start to get discouraged.
Right. Long term, playing the long game is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. Shyla Morgane is here in studio with us, a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. And we're talking about New Year's resolutions. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about New Year's resolutions? Are they a good idea, or do you set goals throughout the year? Does something about New Year's say it is just time to start anew? Do you tell people about your New Year's resolutions, or do you keep them more of a secret to yourself? And do you think that changes whether you achieve them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Shyla, because a lot of people use the new year as an opportunity to look ahead, when they are taking stock of 2019, what are some of the ways that we can productively assess how the year has gone so we can figure out what comes next?
Oh, that's a great, great question. You can think about maybe where you were on January 1st, 2019, and some of the resolutions that you set. And I always encourage people to start with what they did achieve, whether it was a goal that they worked towards and accomplished, or even just something that they developed within themselves, a quality or something they learned, or an experience that they savored, that there were probably many, many benefits. And we tend to look at the negative because we have this negativity bias of our brain, and we tend to overfocus on that bad stuff and remember it in more detail. And I encourage people to actually start with the positive, because there are probably many more positives than negatives. And then you might look after that at one thing that didn't go the way you wanted, and then maybe that's one thing you want to bring forward into 2020 to work towards.
I like systems, putting things together where I can find them and understanding how it works. How do you recommend people think about, work through, track these goals, or even, you know, you're saying look back? I mean, should we be writing this down and acknowledging our achievements in that way? Does that make a difference?
I think actually writing it down can be really powerful, because it's something tangible, and the act of writing can get your ideas out on paper, and you might even come up with something deeper than you would have initially thought of. And I'm a big fan of that reflection back on 2019, the previous year, but then also doing some of that intention setting or resolutions for the upcoming year. Another really powerful tool is to create a vision board or a collage or some images of some of the things you hope to experience or achieve in the upcoming year. It could be pictures of other people, or even posting your face on some of somebody's body doing something, or even a travel destination, or a lesson you want to learn, or a hobby you want to cultivate. I think, again, those visual reminders can help you remember to keep taking action, because it's easy within a couple weeks of the new year to get busy, to get back into your typical routine, and you lose track of, gosh, you know, this is where I want to be, where I want my life to go, and this is what I want to work towards. So those visual reminders are really powerful.
I'm even thinking of scaling that down from a large collage or something. And if I'm saving money for a vacation, you know, putting a picture in my wallet. So every time I open it up, I'd have to see that image again and go, do I really want to spend these $2, or is that better spent someplace else? Even small reminders could probably help us this year.
Absolutely. Something in your wallet, something that pops up on your smartphone or at your desk, or in your bathroom, you could have a little image. And I love that example of thinking about the potential challenges or obstacles that can come up. Creating if that, what then plans. So, and if that happens, if that obstacle comes up, what then will I do? And so you're saying, gosh, if I'm in the store ready to do an impulse purchase, I can open up my wallet and I'll see that image of the travel destination that I want to save towards. And then I can see that and remind myself, no, I actually don't need it. I'd rather save my money for this goal that I want to achieve later in the year.
Sure. So thinking through some of those scenarios ahead of time so we don't get caught and kind of lose sight of those goals?
Absolutely. A little bit of preparation can help you kind of move around those potential challenges to keep on track.
Excellent. Shyla Mergane stays with us as we decide which of our resolutions this year should make the cut, which ones we should justifiably set aside for another year, another time, or maybe just, you know, never. We're taking your strategies for making the most of these New Year's goals. Has including other people in your resolutions helped you in the past? Like joining a support group or going to classes at a gym. Maybe you've told a friend or therapist about your plan. Has it made a difference in your accountability? Maybe you avoid making New Year's resolutions. What is it that just doesn't quite work for you? And how do you make sure that you achieve what you want if you're not setting New Year's resolutions this time of year? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can send us an email instead if you prefer, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm Keely Boltina. Our conversation continues on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. We have mere hours, folks, until we officially say goodbye to 2019 and ring in a brand new year. And with any start, we have the chance to shake off whatever's happened these last 12 months and embrace a shiny new opportunity. Yep, we're talking New Year's resolutions here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to hear from you. What are your New Year's resolutions this year? How do you plan to keep them? What do you wonder about making it more successful? Tell us about a resolution from the past, one that worked for you or one that didn't quite pan out. What do you think tripped you up, and how are you going to do it better next time? 1-800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR. Shyla Morgain is a distinguished psychologist with UW Health who knows a thing or two about setting goals. Shyla, let's talk about support. How important is it for us to have support with our New Year's resolutions?
I always say it takes teamwork to make the dream work, and having those support people can really keep you, your motivation, can keep the momentum, and can pick you up if you fall off course. And in addition to just having that support team, another way of using support is just finding people who have achieved those goals that you're working towards. Could be people you know, or even somebody you don't know, somebody on social media that's achieved it, or an author that you could read their book, or a blogger you could follow. Because what you'll find by tapping into the wisdom of people who've achieved your goal, whether it's they paid off their debt, or weight loss, or they saved for a travel destination, or they've learned a skill that you're hoping to, is that they will think differently and do things differently that may not have ever occurred to you. So you start to really get into their mindset, that success mindset that they have. And as a result, then you can start to shift some of your beliefs, some of your ways of thinking, and even some of the ways that you might be behaving. And in that, you might shift that core belief into more of a success mindset or a growth mindset, versus if the obstacle comes up, it's very easy to give up. But if you can see somebody else who's done it, you're more likely to keep going. And when it gets difficult, kind of get that grit and keep moving forward.
It's a little intimidating, though, to share your goals with other people, because what if you don't achieve them? Then other people know about it, right? Then it's like it might feel like an official failure. How do you move past that worry so that you can, you know, access some of the opportunities you say support offers?
It can feel very vulnerable to have that experience. And so I always encourage people to share your goals with people who are safe, that will love you no matter what, and will feel proud of you for just the effort that it takes. And sometimes goals can take many years to achieve, or sometimes they turn into something else. And so I often think how we view it, it's not a failure, you know, that it's maybe some courage building, and maybe it's preparing you for something even larger or bigger or even more meaningful that you can't imagine that you'll be achieving 3 years from now.
So don't be discouraged. Sometimes we can admit to ourselves, you know, I set that goal, but it doesn't really work for me anymore. And that's okay.
Absolutely. Sometimes we grow into people where what we originally sought out to achieve no longer really fits our lifestyle.
What about the small numbers technique? How can we use that to our advantage?
This is, I think, a really fascinating technique that was based on a 2012 study published in the Journal of Consumer Research. And they found that one of the things that can really trip people up is a perceived lack of progress, saying, oh, it's too much and I have so far to go. But this technique has found that if you focus on the smaller number in reaching a goal, that keeps you more motivated. For example, if you want to lose 15 pounds and you lose 5, instead of saying, oh, I have 10 more pounds to go, you're probably going to feel discouraged. Instead, you could say, I've lost 5. Let me just double that. Let me just times 2. And if you focus on that times 2, you're more likely to keep going. Another example is, let's say you're working out and you're trying to run 5 miles and you've already run 1 mile. If you say, oh, I have 4 miles to go, you're probably likely to give up. Versus you say, I've already run 1 mile. Let me just try to double it. And then, gosh, if I double it, I've already done 2. And then if I double it again, I've done 4 and I'm almost there. So again, focus on that smaller number keeps you motivated.
And then really also in real time, acknowledging the achievement that you have made, because that 1 or 2 pounds, that 1 or 2 miles is real progress.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's often in these small sustainable steps that get you to someplace much larger than you can imagine. I often think when we're working with intentions or resolutions, it's kind of like driving at night. You can only see the next step ahead. You can't see the final destination, or even, you know, five miles down the road. So if you can just focus on, what do I need to do next? What's the next small thing? That will keep you going.
Shyla Morgane is a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. We are taking your calls if you'd like to share your New Year's resolution or have a question about how to make and keep the right goals. The number to call is 800-642-1234. And if you can't get to the phone, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Shyla, we've talked a lot about putting a positive spin on the things that we're working toward. There's some research that says if people focus too much on the great things about that they will achieve, that they experience that positivity in their minds and then they relax and they lose some of the motivation. So how do we make sure that we are thinking positively, but we also are still engaged and motivated to get to that goal and make it a reality?
I think sometimes people can, when they start with the end in mind, can visualize themselves there and think it's just going to happen, like
right.
You're going to wave a magic wand, and we forget of all the action steps that it takes, and often it does get hard somewhere in the middle, and you have to keep going. It's kind of like sometimes there are almost hills we have to climb or swamps we have to go through to keep going, that life is testing us, do we really want this? And so instead of just kind of visualizing the end, you can do that, but I think what can be more effective is just to visualize 10% closer to the goal, just 10% better, or 10% more achievement, or just doing that kind of 10%, because again, that keeps it within that range of something you can accomplish in the next month or even next couple of weeks.
And how do you recommend people keep track of that so that they know what 10% looks like or how many 10%s they've managed to achieve?
I think looking month to month, and say even keeping that in a journal of what have I achieved this month, what didn't go so well, what would I do differently, and what could I focus on for the next month.
And what happens when, you know, life throws you a curveball, something changes, you've been doing really well halfway through the year, and then circumstances just dictate you do something else or can't focus on it. How do we not get discouraged in those moments?
I think going back to that support team, who might be able to brainstorm what didn't go so well, what do we need to do? Sometimes we need to take a break for a while, and that's okay, and then refocus maybe a month later.
Okay, so don't beat yourself up.
Absolutely not. No.
Good.
Yep, you're doing the best you can.
We're talking about this so that we can set goals right away and get a jump start on them right away tomorrow on New Year's Day. What should New Year's Day look like for us if we really want to stick to these resolutions?
In addition to writing down those resolutions or maybe doing some images, finding some images to reflect on them, I encourage people to actually take small action steps towards each resolution. So on New Year's Day, if you want to lose weight, maybe go out for a walk. If you want to save some money, maybe transfer some money into your savings account. If you want to learn a hobby, sign up for a class. If you want to be a better friend, maybe reach out to some friends and wish them Happy New Year. So everything you want to achieve a year from now, think about taking small little action steps on New Year's Day. That means you've already started the day, the new year, with success of moving in that direction of those resolutions.
And then you can't say, oh, I didn't even start on this. I never got started. From day one, you've got these teeny little pieces that kind of launch you into something new.
Yep. And it'll feel good. And it's a great way to celebrate 2020.
All right. Any resolutions you want to share quick before we go?
For me, I'm always into health and fitness, so I'm wanting to try a different form of exercise this year.
Okay.
And I have a puppy, and so we're also going to sign up for our next round of agility to work with her on her agility skills.
A good support system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds great. Shyla, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Shyla Morgane is a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. Her specialty is in health and sports psychology. We've been talking about New Year's resolutions. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Happy 2019. You're listening to the Ideas Network.